Chapter 4. First Impressions, Continued. Hardly had Monsieur Key, the Pole to whom I had been speaking, gone out, when Gazin, completely drunk, threw himself all in a heap into the kitchen. To see a convict drunk in the middle of the day, when everyone was about to be sent out to work, and considering the well-known severity of the governor, who at any moment might visit the barracks, the watchfulness of the under-officer who never left the prison, the presence of the old soldiers and the sentinels, all this quite upset the ideas I had formed of our prison. A long time passed before I was able to understand and explain to myself the effects which, in the first instance, were indeed strange. I have already said that all convicts had a private occupation, and that this occupation was for them a natural and imperious one. They are passionately fond of money, and think more of it than of anything else, almost as much as of liberty. A convict is half consoled if he can wring a few kopecks in his pocket. On the contrary, he is sad, restless, and despondent if he has no money. He is ready then to commit no matter what crime in order to get some. Nevertheless, in spite of its importance in convicts' eyes, money does not remain long in their pockets. It is difficult to keep it. Sometimes it is confiscated, sometimes stolen. When the governor, on one of his sudden raids, discovered a small sum that had been amassed with great trouble, he confiscated it. It may be that he laid it out in improving the food of the prisoners, for all money taken from them went into his hands, but generally speaking it was stolen. A means of preserving it was, however, discovered. An old man from Starodoub, one of the old believers, took upon himself to conceal the convict savings. I cannot resist the desire to say a few words about this man, although it will interrupt my narrative. He was about 60 years old, thin and growing very grey. He excited my curiosity the first time I saw him, for he was not like any of the others. His look was so tranquil and mild. I always saw with pleasure his clear and limpid eyes, surrounded by a number of little wrinkles. I often talked with him, and rarely have I met with so kind, so benevolent a being. He had been condemned to hard labour for a serious crime. A certain number of the old believers at Starodoub had been converted to the Orthodox religion. The government had done everything to encourage them, and, at the same time, to convert the remaining dissenters. This old man and some other fanatics had resolved to defend the faith. When the Orthodox Church was being constructed in their town, they set fire to the building, and this offence had brought upon its author the sentence of deportation. This well-to-do shopkeeper, he was in trade, had left a wife and family whom he loved, and had gone off courageously into exile, believing in his ignorance that he was suffering for the faith. When one had lived some time by the side of this kind old man, one could not help asking the question, how could he have rebelled? I spoke to him several times about his faith. He gave up none of his convictions, but in his answers I never noticed the slightest hatred. And yet he had destroyed a church, and was far from denying it. In his view, the offence he had committed and his martyrdom were things to be proud of. There were other old believers among the convicts, Siberians for the most part, men of well-developed intelligence, and as cunning as all peasants, dialecticians in their way. They followed blindly their law, and delighted in discussing it, but they had great faults. They were haughty, proud, and very intolerant. The old man in no way resembled them. With far more belief in religious exposition than others of the same faith, he avoided all controversy. As he was of a gay and expansive disposition, he often laughed, not with the coarse, cynical laugh of the other convicts, but with a clarity and simplicity in which there was something of the child, and which harmonized perfectly with his grey head. I may perhaps be wrong, but it seems to me that a man's character may be recognized by his mere laugh. If you know a man whose laugh inspires you with sympathy, be assured he is an honest man. The old fellow had won the respect of all the prisoners, without exception, but he was not proud of it. They called him Grandad, and he took no offence. I thus understood what an influence he must have exercised on his co-religionists. In spite of the fortitude with which he endured prison life, one felt that he was tormented by a profound, incurable melancholy. I slept in the same barrack with him. One night, towards 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and heard a slow, stifled sob. The old man was sitting on the stove, the same place where the convict who had wished to kill the governor used to pray, and was reading from his manuscript prayer book. As he wept, I heard him repeating, "Lord, do not forsake me. Master, strengthen me. My poor little children, my dear little children, we shall never see one another again." I cannot say how much this moved me. We used then to entrust our money to this old man. Heaven knows how the idea got abroad in our barrack that he could not be robbed. It was well known that he hid the savings deposited with him, but no one had been able to discover where. He revealed it to us, to the Poles and myself. One of the stakes in the palisade bore a branch which appeared to belong to it, but which could be removed and put back again, and when it was removed, a hole could be seen, and this was his hiding place. But to return to my story, why is it that a convict never saves his money? Well, not only is it difficult for him to keep it, but prison life is so miserable that a man of his very nature thirsts for freedom of action. His position in society makes him so irregular a being that the idea of swallowing up his capital in orgies, of intoxicating himself with revelry, seems to him quite natural, if only he can procure himself one moment's forgetfulness. It was strange to see certain individuals bent over their labour with the sole object of spending their earnings in a single day, even to the last kopeck. Then they would set to work again until they could afford another debauch, which was looked forward to months beforehand. Some convicts were fond of new clothes, more or less singular in style, such as fancy trousers and waistcoats, but it was above all for coloured shirts that they had a pronounced taste, also for belts with metal clasps. On holidays, the prison dandies wore their Sunday best. They were worth seeing as they strutted about their part of the barracks. Their pleasure in feeling themselves well-dressed amounted to childishness. Indeed, in many things, convicts are only children. Their fine clothes, however, disappeared very soon, often in the evening of the very day on which they had been bought. Their owners pledged them, or sold them again for a trifle. Merrymaking generally took place at fixed times. It coincided with religious festivals, or with the name day of some bibulous convict. On getting up in the morning, he would place a wax taper before the icon. Then he said his prayers, dressed, and ordered his dinner. He had previously bought meat, fish, and little patties, which he gorged like an ox, and almost always alone. It was very rare to see one convict invite another to share his repast. At dinner, vodka was produced. The convict would suck it up like the sole of a boot, and then walk through the barracks, swaggering and tottering. He was anxious to show his companions that, although he was drunk, he was carrying on, and thus obtain their particular esteem. The Russians always feel a measure of sympathy for a drunken man. Among us, it amounted really to esteem. In prison, intoxication was regarded as a sort of aristocratic distinction. As soon as he felt himself in high spirits, the convict sent for a musician. We had among us a little fellow, a deserter from the army, very ugly, but who was the happy possessor of a violin on which he could play. As he had no trade, he was always ready to follow the festive convict from barrack to barrack, grinding out dance tunes for him with all his strength. His countenance often expressed the fatigue and disgust which his music, always the same, caused him. But when his employer shouted at him, "Go on playing, aren't you paid for it?" he attacked his violin more strenuously than ever. These drunkards felt sure that they would be taken care of, and, in case of the governor arriving, would be concealed from his watchful eye. This service we rendered in the most disinterested spirit. On their side, the under-office and the old soldiers who remained in the prison to keep order were perfectly reassured. The drunkard would cause no disturbance. At the least scare of revolt or riot, he would have been silenced and tied up. Accordingly, the subordinate officials closed their eyes. They knew that if vodka was forbidden, all would go wrong. How was this vodka procured? It was bought in the prison itself from drink sellers, as they were called, who followed this trade, a very lucrative one, although the tipplers were not very numerous, for revelry was expensive, especially when it is considered how hardly money was earned. The drink business began, continued, and ended in a rather original manner. A prisoner who knew no trade, who would not work, but who, nevertheless, desired to get rich quickly, made up his mind, when he possessed a little money, to buy and sell vodka. The enterprise was risky and required great daring, for the speculator hazarded his skin as well as his liquor, but the drink-seller hesitated before no obstacles. At the outset, he brought the vodka himself to the prison and got rid of it on the most advantageous terms. He repeated this operation a second and a third time. If he had not been discovered by the officials, he now possessed a sum which enabled him to extend his business. He became a capitalist, with agents and assistants. He risked much less and gained much more. Then his assistants incurred the risk instead of him. Prisons are always full of degraded types, who have never learned to work, but who are endowed with skill and daring. Their only capital is their back. They often decide to put it into circulation, and propose to the drink-seller to introduce vodka into the barracks. There is always in the town a soldier, a shopkeeper, or some loose woman, who, for a stipulated sum, quite a small one, buys vodka with the drink-seller's money, hides it in a place known to the convict smuggler near the workshop where he is employed. The person who supplies the vodka almost always tastes the precious liquid as he is carrying it to the hiding place, and never hesitates to replace what he has drunk with pure water. The purchaser may take it or leave it, but he cannot take a high hand. Rather, he thinks himself very lucky that his money has not been stolen, and that he has received some kind of vodka in exchange. The man who is to take it into the prison, to whom the drink-seller has made known the hiding-place, goes to the source of supply with bullock's intestines, which have been washed and filled with water, and which thus preserve their softness and suppleness, fills them with vodka, and rolls them round his body. Now all the cunning, the adroitness of this daring convict is shown. The man's honour is at stake. It is necessary for him to deceive the escort and sentry, and deceive them he will. If the carrier is artful, the escort, sometimes a mere recruit, notices nothing unusual, for the prisoner has studied him thoroughly, and has artfully combined the hour and the place of meeting. If the convict, a bricklayer for example, climbs up on a wall that he is building, the escort will certainly not climb after him to watch his movements. Who then will see what he is about? On nearing the prison, he gets ready a piece of 15 or 20 kopecks and waits at the gate for the corporal on guard. The corporal examines, feels, and searches each convict on his return to barracks, and then opens the gate to him. The smuggler hopes he will be too modest to search him in too much detail, but if the corporal is a cunning fellow, that is just what he will do, and in that case he finds the contraband vodka. The convict has now only one chance of salvation. He slips into the corporal's hand the coin which he holds ready, and often, thanks to this manoeuvre, the vodka arrives safely in the hands of the drink-seller. Sometimes, however, the trick does not succeed, and it is then that the smuggler's sole capital really enters into circulation. A report is made to the governor, who sentences the unhappy culprit to a thorough flogging. As for the vodka, it is confiscated. The smuggler undergoes his punishment without betraying the speculator, not because such a denunciation would disgrace him, but because it would bring him nothing. He would be flogged all the same, and his only consolation would be that the drink-seller would share his punishment. But as he needs him, he does not denounce him, although, having allowed himself to be surprised, he will receive no payment. Denunciation, however, flourishes in prison. Far from hating spies or keeping apart from them, the convicts often make friends of them. If anyone had taken it into his head to try and prove to them the baseness of betraying a fellow prisoner, no one would have understood. The former nobleman of whom I have already spoken, that cowardly and violent creature with whom I had broken off all relations immediately after my arrival in the fortress, was a friend of Fedka, the governor's body servant. He used to tell him everything that went on, all of which was naturally passed on to the servant's master. Everyone knew it, but no one thought of showing any ill will against the man, or of reproaching him with his conduct. When the vodka arrived without accident, the speculator paid the smuggler and made up his accounts. His merchandise had already cost him sufficiently dear, and in order that his profit might be greater, he diluted it still further by adding 50% water. He was then ready, and had only to wait for customers. On the first holiday, or perhaps even on a weekday, he would be approached by a convict who had been working like a negro for many months in order to save up, kopeck by kopeck, the small sum which he was resolved to spend all at once. He had for long looked forward to days of rejoicing, dreamed of them during the endless winter nights, during his hardest labour, and the prospect had supported him under the severest trials. The dawn of this day, so impatiently awaited, has just appeared. He has some money in his pocket. It has been neither stolen from him nor confiscated. He is free to spend it. Accordingly, he takes his savings to the drink-seller, who, to begin with, gives vodka which is almost pure. It has been only twice baptized, but gradually, as the bottle gets more and more empty, he fills it up with water. Accordingly, the convict pays for his vodka 5 or 6 times as much as he would in a tavern. It may be imagined how many glasses, and above all, what sums of money are required before he is drunk. However, as he has lost the habit of drinking, the little alcohol which remains in the liquid intoxicates him rapidly enough. He goes on drinking until there is nothing left. He pledges or sells all his new clothes, for the drink-seller is at the same time a pawnbroker. As his personal garments are not very numerous, he next pledges the clothes supplied to him by the government. When the drink has made away with his last shirt, his last rag, he lies down and wakes up the next morning with a fearful headache. In vain he begs the drink-seller to give him credit for a drop of vodka in order to remove his depression. He meets with a direct refusal. So that very day he sets to work again, and for several months together he will weary himself out while looking forward to one more debauch like that which has now vanished into the past. Little by little he regains courage while waiting for such another day which is still far off, but which will ultimately arrive. As for the drink-seller, if he has gained a large sum, perhaps 12 rubles or so, he procures some more vodka, but this time he does not baptize it, because he intends it for himself. Enough of trade. It is time for him to amuse himself. Accordingly, he eats, drinks, pays for a little music. His means allow him to grease the palm of the junior officials. This festival lasts sometimes for several days. When his stock of vodka is exhausted, he goes and drinks with the other drink-sellers who are waiting for him. There he swallows his last kopeck. However careful the convicts may be in watching over their companions in debauchery, it sometimes happens that the governor or the officer on guard notices what is going on. The drunkard is then dragged to the orderly room. His money is confiscated, if he has any left, and he is flogged. The convict shakes himself like a beaten dog, returns to barracks, and, after a few days, resumes his trade as a drink seller. It sometimes happens that among the convicts there are admirers of the fair sex. For a sufficiently large sum of money, they succeed, accompanied by a soldier whom they have corrupted, in getting secretly out of the fortress into a suburb instead of going to work. There, in an apparently quiet house, a banquet is held, at which large sums of money are spent. The convict's money is not to be despised. Accordingly, the soldiers will sometimes arrange these temporary escapes beforehand, sure as they are of being generously recompensed. Generally speaking, these soldiers are themselves candidates for the convict prison. The escapades are scarcely ever discovered. I must add that they are very rare, for they are very expensive, and the admirers of the fair sex are obliged to have recourse to other less costly means. Soon after my arrival, a young convict with very regular features excited my curiosity. His name was Sirotkin, and he was in many respects an enigmatic being. It was his face that particularly interested me. He was not more than 23 years of age, and he belonged to the special section. That is to say, he was condemned to hard labour for life. He was accordingly to be looked upon as one of the most dangerous of military criminals, yet he was mild and tranquil, spoke little, and rarely laughed. His blue eyes, clear complexion, and fair hair gave him a soft expression, which even his shaved crown did not destroy. Although he had no trade, he managed to obtain money from time to time. He was remarkably lazy, and always slovenly dressed, but if anyone was generous enough to present him with a red shirt, he was beside himself with joy at having a new garment, and exhibited it everywhere. Sirotkin neither drank nor played, and scarcely ever quarrelled with other convicts. He walked about with his hands in his pockets, peacefully and with a pensive air. What he was thinking of I cannot say. When anyone called to him and asked a question, he answered with deference, precisely, and without chattering like the others. He had in his eyes the expression of a child often. When he had money, he bought none of those things which others looked upon as indispensable. His vest might be torn, but he did not get it mended, any more than he bought himself new boots. He was particularly fond of the little white rolls, and also of gingerbread, which he would eat with the satisfaction of a child of seven. When not at work, he wandered about the barracks. When everyone else was occupied, he stood with his arms hanging at his sides. If anyone joked with him or laughed at him, which happened often enough, he turned on his heel without speaking and went elsewhere. If the pleasantry was too strong, he blushed. I often asked myself for what crime he could have been condemned to hard labour. One day, when I was ill and lying in hospital, Sirotkin was also there, stretched out on a bedstead not far from me. I struck up a conversation with him. He became animated and told me freely how he had been conscripted, how his mother had followed him in tears, and what treatment he had suffered in the army. He added that he had never been able to accustom himself to this life. Everyone was severe and angry with him about nothing. His officers were always against him. "But why did they send you here, and into the special section above all, eh, Sirotkin?" "Yes, Alexander Petrovich. Although I was only 1 year with the battalion, I was sent here for killing my captain, Grigory Petrovich." "I heard about that, but I did not believe it. How was it that you killed him? All you heard was true. My life was insupportable. But other recruits stuck it well enough. It's very hard at the beginning, but men get accustomed to it and end by becoming excellent soldiers. Your mother must have pampered and spoiled you. I'm sure that she fed you on gingerbread and sweet milk until you were 18.
"Yes, mother was very fond of me. When I left her, she took to her bed and remained there. My life in the army was terrible, and everything went wrong from the start. I was always being punished, But why? I obeyed every order. I was smart and efficient. I didn't drink or borrow money. It's all up with a man when he begins to borrow, and yet everyone around me was harsh and cruel. I sometimes hid myself in a corner and did nothing but sob. One day, or rather one night, I was on guard. It was autumn. There was a strong wind. It was so dark you couldn't see, and I was sad. So sad. I unfixed my bayonet and laid it by my side. Then I put the musket to my breast, and with my big toe, I had taken my boot off, pressed the trigger. It missed fire. I examined it and reloaded it with a charge of fresh powder. Then I broke off the corner of my flint, and once more placed the muzzle against my breast. Again there was a misfire. What was I to do? I asked myself. I put my boot on, fixed bayonet, sloped, and then paced up and down. Let them do what they like, I said to myself, but I will not be a soldier any longer. Half an hour afterwards the captain arrived, making his rounds. He came straight up to me. Is that the way you carry yourself when you're on guard? I gripped the musket and drove the bayonet into him. Then I had to walk 46 versts. That is how I came to be in the special section. He was not lying, but I did not understand how they could have sent him there. Such crimes deserve much less severe punishment. Sirotkin was the only one of the convicts who was really handsome. As for his companions of the special section, to the number of 15, they were frightful to behold with their hideous, disgusting physiognomies. Grey heads were plentiful among them. I shall speak of these men again. Sirotkin was often on good terms with Gazin, the drink-seller whom I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter. This Gazin was a terrible man. The impression he made on everyone was confusing or appalling. It seemed to me that a more ferocious, a more monstrous creature could not exist. Yet at Tobolsk I had seen the notorious brigand Kamanev. Later I saw Sokolov, the escaped convict, formerly a deserter who was a ferocious creature. Neither of them, however, filled me with so much disgust as did Gazin. I often fancied that I had before my eyes an enormous, gigantic spider the size of a man. He was a Tartar, and there was no convict so strong as he. It was less by his great height and his Herculean build than by his enormous deformed head that he inspired terror. The strangest reports were current about him. Some said that he had been a soldier, others that he had escaped from Nerchinsk, and that he had been exiled several times to Siberia, but had always succeeded in getting away. He ended at last in our prison, where he belonged to the special section. It appeared that he used to delight in luring small children to some lonely spot. There he would frighten and torture them, gloat over the terror and convulsions of the poor little things, and finally dispatch them with fiendish glee. These horrors had perhaps been imagined because of the revolting impression that the monster produced upon us, but they seemed probable and harmonized with his physiognomy. Nevertheless, when Gazin was not drunk, he conducted himself quite well. He was always quiet, never quarrelled, avoided all disputes, as if from contempt for his companions, just as though he had entertained a high opinion of himself. He spoke very little, and all his movements were measured, calm, resolute. His look was not without intelligence, but its expression was cruel and derisive like his smile. Of all the convicts who sold vodka, he was the richest. Twice a year he got completely drunk, and it was then that all his brutal ferocity was laid bare. Little by little he became excited, and began to tease his fellow prisoners with venomous satire thought out long beforehand. At length, when he was quite drunk, he had attacks of furious rage, and, seizing a knife, would rush upon his companions. The convicts, who knew his Herculean strength, avoided him and protected themselves against him, for he would throw himself on the first person he met. A means of disarming him had been discovered, some dozen prisoners would rush suddenly upon Gazin and give him violent blows in the pit of the stomach, in the belly, and generally below the region of the heart until he lost consciousness. Anyone else would have died under such treatment, but Gazin soon recovered. When he had been well beaten, they would wrap him up in his pelisse and throw him upon his plank bedstead, leaving him to digest his drink. The next day he woke up almost well, and went about his work, silent and sombre. Every time Gazin got drunk, the whole prison knew how his day would finish. He knew also, but he drank all the same. Several years passed in this way. Then it was noticed that Gazin had lost his energy, and that he was beginning to weaken. He did nothing but groan, complaining of all kinds of illnesses. His visits to the hospital became more and more frequent. "He is giving in," said the prisoners. On one occasion, Gazin had gone into the kitchen, followed by the little fellow who scraped the violin, and whom the convicts, during their festivities, used to hire to play for them. He stopped in the middle of the hall, silently examining his companions one after another. No one breathed a word. When he saw me with my companions, he looked at us in his malicious, jeering way, and smiled horribly, with the air of a man pleased with a good joke that had just occurred to him. He tottered over to our table. "Might I ask," he said, "where you get the money which enables you to drink tea?" I exchanged a look with my neighbour. I realised that the best thing for us was to be silent and not to answer. The least contradiction would have thrown Gazin in a passion. "You must have money," he continued. "You must have a great deal of money to drink tea. But tell me, are you sent to hard labour to drink tea? I say, did you come here for that purpose? Please answer. I should like to know." Seeing that we were resolved on silence, and that we had determined not to pay any attention to him, he ran towards us, livid and trembling with rage. A couple of yards away, he caught sight of a heavy box which ordinarily contained loaves for issue at dinner and supper, and held enough bread for the meal of half the prisoners. At this moment, however, it was empty. Gazin seized it with both hands and brandished it above our heads. Although murder, or attempted murder, was a source of endless trouble for the convicts, examinations, counter-examinations, and inquiries without end would be the natural consequence, and though quarrels were generally cut short when they did not lead to such serious results, yet everyone remained silent and waited. Not one word in our favour, not one cry against Gazin. The hatred felt for all who were of gentle birth was so great that everyone was evidently pleased to see us in danger. But a fortunate incident cut short this scene, which must otherwise have a tragic ending. Gazin was about to let fly the enormous box, which he was turning and twisting above his head, when a convict ran in from the barracks and cried out, "Gazin! They've stolen your vodka!" The terrible brigand let fall the box with a frightful oath and ran out of the kitchen. "Well, God has saved them," said the prisoners among themselves, repeating the words several times. I never knew whether his vodka had been stolen, or whether it was only a stratagem intended to save us. That same evening, before the barracks were locked up, but when it was already dark, I walked to the side of the palisade. A heavy feeling of sadness weighed upon my soul. During the whole period of my imprisonment, I never felt so miserable as on that evening, though the first day is always the hardest, whether at hard labour or confined to the prison. One thought in particular had left me no respite since my deportation, a question insoluble then and insoluble now. I reflected on the inequality of the punishments inflicted for the same crimes. Often, indeed, one crime cannot be compared even approximately with another. Two murderers kill a man under different circumstances, which in each case are minutely examined and weighed. They each receive the same punishment, And yet, by what an abyss are their two actions separated? One has committed a murder for a trifle, for an onion. He has killed a passing yokel on the high road, and found on him no more than an onion. Well, I was sent to hard labour for killing a peasant who had nothing but an onion. Well, you're a fool. An onion is worth a kopeck. If you'd killed 100 peasants, you would have had 100 kopecks, or 1 ruble. The foregoing is a prison joke. Another criminal has killed a debauchee who was oppressing or dishonouring his wife, his sister, or his daughter. A third, a vagabond half-dead with hunger and pursued by a whole band of police, was defending his liberty, his life. He is to be regarded as on an equal footing with the brigand who assassinates children for amusement, for the pleasure of feeling their warm blood flow over his hands, of seeing them shudder in a last bird-like palpitation beneath the knife which tears their flesh. They will all alike be sent to hard labour, though the sentence will perhaps not be for the same number of years. Degrees of punishment, however, are not very numerous, whereas different kinds of crime may be reckoned by thousands. There are as many crimes as there are characters. Let us admit that it is impossible to get rid of this first inequality of punishment, that the problem is insoluble, and, in the sphere of penal law, like trying to square the circle. Let all that be admitted. But even if this inequality cannot be avoided, there is another thing to be thought of, the consequences of the punishment. Here is a man who is wasting away like a candle. There is another, on the contrary, who had no idea before going into exile that there could be such a gay, such an idle life, where he would find a circle of such agreeable friends. Individuals of this latter class are to be found in every prison. Now take a man who is sensitive, cultured, and of delicate conscience. What he feels kills him more surely than the material punishment. The judgment which he himself pronounces on his crime is more pitiless than that of the most severe tribunal, the most draconian law. He lives side by side with another convict, who has not once during all his time in prison reflected on the murder he is expiating. He may even consider himself innocent. Are there not also poor devils who commit crimes in order to be sent to hard labour, and thus to escape from a freedom which is much more painful than confinement? So-and-so has led a miserable life. He has never, perhaps, been able to satisfy his hunger. He is worked to death in order to enrich his master. In prison, his work will be less severe, less crushing. He will eat as much as he wants, better than he could ever have hoped to eat had he remained free. On holidays he will have meat, and fine people will give him alms, and his evening's work will bring him in some money. And then again, is prison society to be counted for nothing? The convicts are clever, wide-awake people who are up to everything. The new arrival can scarcely conceal the admiration he feels for his companions in labour. He has seen nothing like it before, and he will consider himself in the best company possible. Is it possible that men so differently situated can feel in an equal degree the punishment inflicted? But why think about questions that are insoluble? The drum beats, and we must return to barracks.